This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Girl at War by Sara Novich. Read for you by Julia Whalen. I had come to Yugoslavia to see what history meant in flesh and blood. I learned now that it might follow, because an empire passed, that a world full of strong men and women and rich food and heady wine might nevertheless seem like a shadow show, that a man of every excellence might sit by a fire warming his hands in the vain hope of casting out a chill that lived not in the flesh. Rebecca West, Black Lamb and Gray Falcon. I see pictures merging before my mind's eye, paths through the fields, river meadows and mountain pastures mingling with images of destruction. And oddly enough, it is the latter, not the now entirely unreal idols of my early childhood, that make me feel rather as if I were coming home. W.G. Sebald, On the Natural History of Destruction. Part 1. They Both Fell. Chapter 1. The war in Zagreb began over a pack of cigarettes. There had been tensions beforehand, rumors of disturbances in other towns whispered above my head, but no explosions, nothing outright. Caught between the mountains, Zagreb sweltered in the summer, and most people abandoned the city for the coast during the hottest months. For as long as I could remember, my family had vacationed with my godparents in a fishing village down south. But the Serbs had blocked the roads to the sea. At least that's what everyone was saying, so for the first time in my life, we spent the summer inland. Everything in the city was clammy. Doorknobs and train handrails slick with other people's sweat, the air heavy with the smell of yesterday's lunch. We took cold showers and walked around the flat in our underwear. Under the run of cool water, I imagined my skin sizzling, steam rising from it. At night, we lay atop our sheets, awaiting fitful sleep and fever dreams. I turned 10 in the last week of August, a celebration marked by a soggy cake and eclipsed by heat and disquiet. My parents invited their best friends, my godparents, Petar and Marina, over for dinner that weekend. The house where we usually stayed the summers belonged to Petar's grandfather. My mother's break from teaching allowed us 3 months of vacation, my father taking a train, meeting us later, and the five of us would live there together on the cliffs along the Adriatic. Now that we were landlocked, the weekend dinners had become an anxious charade of normalcy. Before Petar and Marina arrived, I argued with my mother about putting on clothes. "You're not an animal, Anna. You'll wear shorts to dinner or you'll get nothing." "In Tiska, I only wear my swimsuit bottoms anyway," I said. But my mother gave me a look, and I got dressed. That night, the adults were engaging in their regular debate about exactly how long they'd known each other. They had been friends since before they were my age, they liked to say, no matter how old I was, and after the better part of an hour and a bottle of Ferravino, they'd usually leave it at that. Petar and Marina had no children for me to play with, so I sat at the table holding my baby sister and listening to them vie for the farthest-reaching memory. Rahela was only 8 months old and had never seen the coast, so I talked to her about the sea and our little boat, and she smiled when I made fish faces at her. After we ate, Petar called me over and handed me a fistful of dinar.
"Let's see if you can beat your record," he said.
It was a game between us. I would run to the store to buy his cigarettes and he would time me. If I beat my record, he'd let me keep a few dinar from the change. I stuffed the money in the pocket of my cutoffs and took off down the 9 flights of stairs. I was sure I was about to set a new record. I'd perfected my route, knew when to hug the curves around buildings and avoid the bumps in the side streets. I passed the house with the big orange "Beware of Dog" sign, though no dog ever lived there that I could remember, jumped over a set of cement steps, and veered away from the dumpsters. Under a concrete archway that always smelled like piss, I held my breath and sped into the open city. I skirted the biggest pothole in front of the bar frequented by the daytime drinkers, slowing only slightly as I came upon the old man at his folding table, hawking stolen chocolates. The newsstand kiosk's red awning shifted in a rare breeze, signaling me like a finish line flag. I put my elbows on the counter to get the clerk's attention. Mr. Petrovich knew me and knew what I wanted, but today his smile looked more like a smirk.
Do you want Serbian cigarettes or Croatian ones?
The way he stressed the two nationalities sounded unnatural. I had heard people on the news talking about Serbs and Croats this way because of the fighting in the villages, but no one had ever said anything to me directly, and I didn't want to buy the wrong kind of cigarettes. Can I have the ones I always get, please?
Serbian or Croatian?
You know, the gold wrapper? I tried to see around his bulk, pointing to the shelf behind him, but he just laughed and waved to another customer who sneered at me. Hey! I tried to get the clerk's attention back. He ignored me and made change for the next man in line. I'd already lost the game, but I ran home as fast as I could anyway. Mr. Petrovich wanted me to pick Serbian or Croatian cigarettes, I told Petar. I didn't know the answer and he wouldn't give me any. I'm sorry. My parents exchanged looks, and Petar motioned for me to sit on his lap. He was tall, taller than my father, and flushed from the heat and wine. I climbed up on his wide thigh.
It's okay,
he said, patting his stomach.
I'm too full for cigarettes anyway.
I pulled the money from my shorts and relinquished it. He pressed a few dinar coins into my palm. But I didn't win.
Yes,
he said.
But today, that's not your fault.
That night, my father came into the living room, where I slept, and sat down on the bench of the old upright piano. We'd inherited the piano from an aunt of Petar's. He and Marina didn't have space for it, but we couldn't afford to have it tuned, and the first octave was so flat all the keys gave out the same tired tone. I heard my father pressing the foot pedals down in rhythm with the habitual nervous jiggle of his leg, but he didn't touch the keys. After a while, he got up and came to sit on the armrest of the couch where I lay. Soon, we were going to buy a mattress.
Anna, you awake?
I tried to open my eyes, felt them flitting beneath the lids. Awake, I managed.
Filter 160s. They're Croatian, so you know for next time.
Filter 160s, I said, committing it to memory. My father kissed my forehead and said goodnight, but I felt him in the doorway moments later, his body blocking out the kitchen lamplight.
If I'd been there,
he whispered, but I wasn't sure he was talking to me, so I stayed quiet, and he didn't say anything else. In the morning, Milosevic was on TV giving a speech, and when I saw him, I laughed. He had big ears and a fat red face, jowls sagging like a dejected bulldog. His accent was nasal, nothing like the gentle, throaty voice of my father. Looking angry, he hammered his fist in rhythm with his speech. He was saying something about cleansing the land, repeating it over and over. I had no idea what he was talking about, but as he spoke and pounded, he got redder and redder. So I laughed, and my mother poked her head around the corner to see what was so funny. Turn that off. I felt my cheeks go hot, thinking she was mad at me for laughing at what must have been an important speech. But her face softened quickly. Go play, she said. Bet Luka's already beat you to the Turk. My best friend Luka and I spent the summer biking around the town square and meeting our classmates for pickup football games. We were freckled and tan and perpetually grass-stained, and now that we were down to just a few weeks of freedom before the start of school, we met even earlier and stayed out later, determined not to let any vacation go to waste. I found him along our regular bike route. We cycled side by side, Luca occasionally swinging his front tire into mine so that we'd nearly crash. It was a favorite joke of his, and he laughed the whole way, but I was still thinking about Petrovich. In school, we'd been taught to ignore distinguishing ethnic factors, though it was easy enough to discern someone's ancestry by their last name. Instead, we were trained to regurgitate pan-Slavic slogans.
Bratstvo I jedinstvo.
Brotherhood and unity. But now it seemed the differences between us might be important after all. Luka's family was originally from Bosnia, a mixed state, a confusing third category. Serbs wrote in Cyrillic and Croats in the Latin alphabet, but in Bosnia they used both, the spoken differences even more minute. I wondered if there was a special brand of Bosnian cigarettes too, and whether Luka's father smoked those. When we arrived in the Turg, it was crowded, and I could tell something was wrong. In light of this new Serb-Croat divide, everything, including the statue of Banja Lacic, sword drawn, now seemed a clue to the tensions I hadn't seen coming. During World War II, the Bonn sword was aimed toward the Hungarians in a defensive gesture, but afterward the communists had removed the statue in a neutralization of nationalistic symbols. Luka and I had watched when, after the last elections, men with ropes and heavy machinery returned Jelačić to his post. Now he was facing south, toward Belgrade. The Turg had always been a popular meeting place, but today people were swarming around the base of the statue looking frantic, milling through a snarl of trucks and tractors parked right in the cobblestone Turg, where, on normal days, cars weren't even allowed to drive. Baggage, shipping crates, and an assortment of free-floating housewares brimmed over the backs of flatbeds and were splayed across the square. I thought of the gypsy camp my parents and I once passed while driving to visit my grandparents' graves in Chalkovitz, caravans of wagons and trailers housing mysterious instruments and stolen children. "They'll pour acid in your eyes," my mother warned when I wiggled in the pew while my father lit candles and prayed for his parents. "Little blind beggars earn 3 times as much as ones who can see." I held her hand and was quiet for the rest of the day. Luca and I dismounted our bikes and moved cautiously toward the mass of people and their belongings. But there were no bonfires or circus sideshows. There was no music. These were not the migrant people I'd seen on the outskirts of the northern villages. The settlement was made almost entirely out of string. Ropes, twine, shoelaces, and strips of fabric of various thicknesses were strung from cars to tractors to piles of luggage in an elaborate tangle. The strings supported the sheets and blankets and bigger articles of clothing that served as makeshift tents. Luca and I stared alternately at each other and at the strangers, not knowing the words for what we were seeing, but understanding that it wasn't good. Candles circled the perimeter of the encampment, melting next to boxes on which someone had written, "Contributions for the Refugees." Most people who passed added something to a box, some emptying their pockets.
"Who are they?"
I whispered.
"I don't know," Luca said. "Should we give them something?"
I took Petar's dinar from my pocket and gave them to Luca, afraid to get too close myself. Luca had a few coins, too, and I held his bike while he put them in the box. As he leaned in, I panicked, worrying that the city of string would swallow him up like the vines that come alive in horror movies. When he turned around, I shoved his handlebars at him, and he stumbled backward. As we rode away, I felt my stomach twist into a knot I would only years later learn to call survivor's guilt. My classmates and I often met for football matches on the east side of the park, where the grass had fewer lumps. I was the only girl who played football, but sometimes other girls would come down to the field to jump rope and gossip.
"Why do you dress like a boy?"
a pigtailed girl asked me once.
"It's easier to play football in pants," I told her.
The real reason was that they were my neighbor's clothes, and we couldn't afford anything else. We began collecting stories. They started out with strings of complex relationships, my best friend's second cousin, my uncle's boss, and whoever kicked the ball between improvised and ever-negotiable goal markers got to tell their story first. An unspoken contest of gore developed, honoring whoever could more creatively describe the blown-out brains of their distant acquaintances. Stiepan's cousins had seen a mine explode a kid's leg, little bits of skin clinging to grooves in the sidewalk for a week afterward. Tomislav had heard of a boy who was shot in the eye by a sniper in Zagora. His eyeball had turned to liquid like a runny egg right there in front of everyone. At home, my mother paced the kitchen, talking on the phone to friends in other towns, then hung out the window, passing the news to the next apartment building over. I stood close while she discussed the mounting tensions on the banks of the Danube with the women on the other side of the clothesline, absorbing as much as I could before running off to find my friends. A citywide spy network, we passed on any information we overheard, relaying stories of victims whose links to us were becoming less and less remote. On the first day of school, our teacher took attendance and found one of our classmates missing. "Anyone here from Zlatko?" she said.
"Maybe he went back to Serbia where he belongs," said Mate, a boy I'd always found obnoxious.
A few people snickered, and our teacher shushed them. Beside me, Stiepan raised his hand. "He moved," Stiepan said.
"Moved?"
Our teacher flipped through some papers on her clipboard.
"Are you sure?"
"He lived in my building. Two nights ago I saw his family carrying big suitcases out to a truck. He said they had to leave before the air raid started. He said to tell everyone goodbye." The class erupted into high-strung chatter at this news. "What's an air raid? Who will be our goalie now? Good riddance to him." "Shut up, Mate," I said.
"Enough,"
said our teacher. We quieted. An air raid, she explained, was when planes flew over cities and tried to knock buildings down with bombs. She drew chalky maps denoting shelters, listed the necessities our families should bring underground with us. AM radio, water jug, flashlight, batteries for the flashlight. I didn't understand whose planes wanted what buildings to explode, or how to tell a regular plane from a bad one, though I was happy for the reprieve from regular lessons. But soon she began to swipe at the board, inciting an angry cloud of eraser dust. She let out a sigh, as if she were impatient with air raids, brushing the settling chalk away from the pleats in her skirt. We moved on to long division, and were not offered a time for asking questions. It happened when I was running errands for my mother. I was supposed to get milk, which came in slippery plastic bags that wiggled during any attempt at pouring or gripping, and I'd rigged a cardboard box to my bike's handlebars to carry the uncooperative cargo. But all the stores nearest our flat had run out. Stores were running out of everything now, and I commissioned Luca to join the quest. Expanding the search, we ventured deeper into the city. The first plane flew so low, Luca and I swore later to anyone who would listen that we'd seen the pilot's face. I ducked, my handlebars twisting beneath me, and fell from my bike. Luca, who'd been looking skyward but had forgotten to stop pedaling, crashed into my wreckage and landed face down, cutting his chin on the cobblestone. We scrambled to our feet, adrenaline overriding pain as we tried to right our bikes. Then the alarm, the grained crackle of shoddy audio equipment, the howl of the siren like a woman crying out through a megaphone. We ran, across the street and through the side alleys.
"Which one's closest?"
Luca called over the noise. I visualized the map on the blackboard at school, stars and arrows marking different paths.
"There's one underneath the kindergarten."
Beneath the slide of our first playground, a set of cement steps led to a steel door, triple thick, as fat as a dictionary. Two men held the door open, and people funneled from all directions down into the shadows. Reluctant to leave our bicycles to fend for themselves in the impending doom, Luca and I dropped them as close to the entrance as possible. The shelter smelled of mold and unwashed bodies. When my eyes adjusted, I surveyed the room. There were bunk beds, a wooden bench near the door, and a generator bicycle in the far corner. My classmates and I would come to fight over the bike in subsequent raids, elbowing one another for a turn converting pedals into the electricity that powered the lights in the shelter. But the first time, we barely noticed it. We were occupied with surveying the odd collection of people seized from their daily activities and smashed together in a Cold War lair. I studied the group closest to me. Men in business suits, or coveralls and mechanics jackets like my father's, women in pantyhose and pencil skirts, others in aprons with babies at their hips. I wondered where my mother and Rahela were. There was no public shelter near our building. Then I heard Luca calling for me and realized we'd been separated by an influx of newcomers. I felt my way in his direction, identifying him by the outline of his unruly hair.
"You're bleeding," I said.
Luca wiped his chin with his arm, tried to make out the line of blood on his sleeve.
"I thought it would happen. I heard my dad talking about it last night."
Luca's father worked for the police academy and was in charge of training new recruits. I was annoyed Luca hadn't mentioned the possibility of a raid earlier. He looked comfortable there in the dark, his arm draped on the rung of a bunk bed ladder.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I didn't want to scare you."
"I'm not scared," I said.
I wasn't. Not yet. The siren again, signaling an all clear. The men pressed back the door, and we ascended the stairs, unsure of what to expect. Above ground it was still daylight, and the sun obscured my vision as much as darkness had below. I saw spots. When they dissipated, the playground came into focus, just as I'd remembered it. Nothing had happened. At home, I barged through the front door, announcing to my mother that there was no milk left in the entire city of Zagreb. She pushed her chair back from the kitchen table, where she'd been grading a pile of student assignments, and shifted Rahela closer up against her chest as she stood. Rahela cried.
"Are you okay?"
my mother asked. She gathered me up in a forceful embrace.
"I'm fine. We went to the kindergarten. Where'd you and Rahela go?"
"In the basement, by the Schuppe."
The basement of our building had only two notable characteristics, filth and Schuppe. Every family had a Schuppe, a padlocked wooden storage unit. I loved to press my face against the gap between the door and the hinges to see inside, a private viewing of a family's lowliest possessions. We kept potatoes in ours, and they fared well in the darkness. The basement didn't seem very safe. There wasn't a big metal door or bunk beds or a generator. But my mother seemed sad when I asked about it later.
"It's just as good a place as any," she said.
That night my father came home with a shoebox full of brown packing tape he'd pilfered from the tram office where he worked some days. He pulled big sticky X's diagonally across the windows, and I followed behind him, pressing the tape down, smoothing out the air bubbles. We put a double layer on the French doors that led to the little balcony off the living room. The balcony was my favorite part of our flat. If I ever felt a twinge of disappointment after coming home from Luca's house, where his mother did not have to work and he slept in a real bed, I would step outside and lie on my back, letting my feet swing over the ledge, and reason that no one who lived in a house could have a high-up balcony like mine. Now, though, I worried that my father would tape the doors shut.
"We'll still be able to go outside, right?"
"Of course, Anna. We're just shoring up the glass."
The tape was supposed to hold the windows together if there was an explosion.
"And anyway,"
my father said, sounding tired,
"a little packing tape's not good for much."
Chapter 2.
"Which color are we again?"
I stood behind my father, resting my chin on his shoulder as he read the newspaper and pointed to a map of Croatia splashed with red and blue dots indicating the opposing armies. He'd already told me once, but I couldn't keep it straight.
"Blue,"
my father said.
"The Croatian National Guard, the police."
"And the red ones?"
"Yugoslavenska Narodna Armija, the JNA.
I didn't understand why the Yugoslav National Army would want to attack Croatia, which was full of Yugoslavian people, but when I asked my father, he just sighed and closed the paper. In the process, I glimpsed the front page, a photo of men waving chainsaws and skull-emblazoned flags. They had felled a tree across a road, blocking passage in both directions. The headline, "Tree Trunk Revolution," ran across the bottom of the page in fat black type. "Who are they?" I asked my father. The men were bearded and wearing mismatched uniforms. In all the military parades, I'd never seen JNA soldiers carrying pirate flags.
"Chetniks,"
he said, folding the paper and tucking it on a shelf above the television, out of my reach.
"What are they doing with the trees, and why do they have beards if they're in the army?"
I knew the beards were important because I'd noticed all the shaving. Across the city, men with more than 2 days' stubble were eyed suspiciously by their clean-shaven counterparts. The week before, Luca's father had shaved off the beard he'd worn since before Luca and I were born. Unable to part with it completely, he'd left his mustache, but the effect was mostly comical. The bushy whiskers atop his upper lip were a specter of the face we'd known, and left him looking perpetually forlorn.
"They're Orthodox. In their church, men grow beards when they're in mourning."
"What are they sad about?"
"They're waiting for the Serb king to be returned to his throne."
"We don't even have a king."
"That's enough, Anna,"
my father said. I wanted to know more, what a beard had to do with being sad, why the Serbs had both the JNA and the Chetniks on their side, and we only had the old police force. But my mother set a knife and a bowl of unpeeled potatoes in front of me before I could bring it up. Amid the disorder, Luca analyzed. It had always been his habit to ask me questions I couldn't answer, hypotheticals that supplied our bike rides with endless conversation. We used to speak mostly of outer space, how it was possible that a star was already dead by the time we saw it shooting, why airplanes and birds stayed up and we stayed down, and whether or not, on the moon, you'd have to drink everything from a straw. But now his investigative attentions had turned exclusively to the war. What did Milosevic mean when he said the country needed to be cleansed, and how was a war supposed to help when the explosions were making such a big mess? Why did the water keep running out if the pipes were underground, and if the bombings were breaking the pipes, were we any safer in the shelters than in our houses? I'd always loved Luca's inquiries, and that he trusted my opinion. With other friends, the boys at school, he usually just kept quiet. And given the grown-up's penchant for evading my questions, it was a relief to have someone who'd talk about it all. But the moon was far away, and now that he was dissecting issues so close to home, I found my head aching with the idea that all the familiar faces and parts of the city were pieces of a puzzle I couldn't fit together.
"What if we die in an air raid?" he said one afternoon.
"Well, they haven't actually blown any buildings up yet," I reasoned.
"But what if they do, and one of us dies?"
Somehow, the prospect of just him dying was a scarier place than I'd allowed my imagination to go thus far. I felt sweaty and nervous, unzipped my jacket. I was so rarely angry with him I almost didn't recognize the feeling.
"You're not going to die," I said, "so you can just forget about it."
I took a sharp turn and left him there alone in the Turg, where the refugees were untangling their belongings and getting ready to make their next move. We entered an era of false alarms, air raid warnings and pre-air raid warnings. Whenever police reconnaissance spotted Serb planes approaching the city, A strip of alert text ribboned its way across the top of the television screen. No siren sounded, no one ran to the shelters, but those who'd seen the warning would poke their heads out into the hallway and begin the call. Zamrachenye! Zamrachenye! It drifted down the stairwells, across clotheslines to neighboring buildings, through the streets, the air humming with the foreboding murmur, "Darken it." We pulled the blinds over our taped-up panes, secured strips of black cloth atop the shades. Sitting on the floor in the dark, I wasn't afraid. The feeling was more like expectation during a particularly intense round of hide-and-seek.
"Something's wrong with her," my mother said, one night when we were squatting beneath the windowsill.
Rahela cried, was still crying, it seemed, from a spell she'd begun a few days earlier. "Maybe she's afraid of the dark," I said, though I knew that wasn't it.
"I'm taking her to the doctor." "She's fine," my father said in a way that ended the discussion.
A Serbian man who lived in our building refused to pull down his shades. He turned on all the lights in his flat and, through the most impressive of boomboxes, blasted cassettes of garish orchestral music that had been popular during the height of communism. At night, families took turns begging him to turn out his lights. They asked him to have a heart and help them protect their children. When that didn't work, they appealed to logic, reasoning that if the apartment building was bombed, he would surely die in the explosion as well. He seemed willing to make the sacrifice. On weekends, when he was in the car park working on his broken Yugo, we lurked around the lot and stole his tools when he wasn't looking. Some mornings before school, we'd gather in the hallway outside his flat. We'd buzz his doorbell again and again, and run when we heard him pad toward the door. The refugee kids showed up at school a few weeks after their arrival in the city. With no record of their academic skills, the teachers tried to divide them among the classes as evenly as possible. Our class got two boys who looked close enough to our age to blend in. They were from Vukovar and spoke with funny accents. Vukovar was a small city a few hours away and had never meant much to me during peacetime, but now it was always in the news. In Vukovar, people were disappearing. People were being forced at gunpoint to march east. People were becoming hemic vapor amid the nighttime explosions. The boys had walked all the way to Zagreb, and they didn't like to talk about it. Even after they settled in, they were always a little dirtier, the circles beneath their eyes a little darker than ours, and we treated them with a distant curiosity. They were living in a warehouse we'd referred to before as Sahara, because of its desertedness. It was where the older kids used to go to talk and smoke and kiss in the dark. Rumors swelled. People were sleeping on the floor, and there was only one bathroom, or maybe not even any bathroom, and definitely no toilet paper. Luca and I tried to sneak in a few times, but a soldier was checking refugees' documents at the door. Soon they were checking IDs at the front of my apartment building, too. Families in the building alternated sending an adult down in 5-hour shifts to guard the door, an attempt to prevent some Chetnik from coming in and blowing himself up. One night there was an argument. The men outside were yelling so loudly we could hear it through the window. The guard didn't want to let the Serbian man back in.
"You're an animal! You're trying to get our children killed!" the doorman screamed. "I'm doing nothing of the sort. Then turn your fucking lights out during the blackout." "I'll turn your lights out, you filthy Muslim," said the Serb, followed by more shouting and grunting.
My father opened our window and stuck his head out.
"You're both animals," he said. "We're trying to get some sleep up here."
The noise woke Rahela, who resumed her crying. My mother glared at my father and went into the bedroom to retrieve my sister from her cradle. My father pulled on his work boots and ran downstairs to keep the brawl from getting out of hand. All the policemen were away being soldiers, and there was no one else left to do it.
"Will you have to go to the army someday?" I asked my father.
"I'm not a policeman," he said.
"Stepan's dad isn't either, and he had to go."
My father sighed and rubbed his forehead.
Let's get you back in bed.
He scooped me up with a deft swing of his arm and plopped me on the couch.
The truth is, I'm embarrassed, but I'm not allowed to be in the army because of my eye.
My father had a crooked eye and couldn't tell near from far. Even when driving, he'd sometimes close the bad eye and squint the other, guessing his distance from cars and hoping for the best. He'd learned to make do this way, and liked to brag that he'd never had an accident. But the police-turned-army were harder to convince that hoping for the best was an effective methodology, particularly when grenades were involved.
At least for now. Maybe if forces are down, I could be a radio operator or a mechanic. Not a real soldier, though.
That's not embarrassing, I said. You can't help it.
But it'd be better if I could protect the country, no?
I'm glad you can't go. My father bent to kiss my forehead.
Well, I would miss you, I suppose.
The lights flickered, then went out.
All right, she's going to bed, he said to the ceiling, and I giggled.
He went into the kitchen, and I heard him bumping around in search of matches. In the top drawer by the sink? I called. I switched off the lamp in case the electricity came back in the middle of the night, and willed myself to sleep amid the sudden silence of our flat. As a side effect of modern warfare, we had the peculiar privilege of watching the destruction of our country on television. There were only two channels, and with tank and trench battles happening across the eastern counties, and JNA ground troops within 100 kilometers of Zagreb, both were devoted to public service announcements, news reports, or political satire, a burgeoning genre now that the secret police were no longer a concern. The anxiety that arose from being away from the television, the radio, our friends' latest updates, from not knowing, panged our stomachs like a physical hunger. The news became the backdrop to all our meals, so much so that televisions lingered in the kitchens of Croatian households long after the war was over. My mother taught English at the technical high school, and she and I arrived home from our respective schools around the same time, I dirt-streaked, and she fatigue-stricken, and carrying Rahela, who spent the school days with the old woman across the hall. We'd turn on the news, and my mother would hand Rahela off to me while she wielded her wooden spoon to create another meal from water and carrots and chunks of chicken carcass. I'd sit at the kitchen table with Rahela on my lap and tell them both what I'd learned that day. My parents were strict about school, my mother because she had been to college, and my father because he hadn't, and my mother would interject questions about my times tables or spelling words, little quizzes, after which she sometimes rewarded me with a bit of sweetbread she hid in the cabinet under the sink. One afternoon, an extra-large block of special report text caught my attention, and I let my account of the day's lessons trail off and turned up the television. The reporter, pressing on her earpiece, announced there was breaking news, uncut footage from the southern front in Šibenik. My mother darted away from the stove and stood behind me to watch. An unsteady cameraman jumped a ledge to get a better view as a Serbian plane spiraled toward the sea, its engine on fire and blending with the late September sunset. Then, to the right, a second plane ignited in midair. The cameraman spun around to reveal a Croatian anti-aircraft soldier pointing incredulously at his handiwork, saying, Oba dva! Oba supala! Both of them. They both fell. The Oba supala footage played on both television channels for the remainder of the day and continuously throughout the war. Oba supala became a rallying cry, and whenever it appeared on TV, or when someone yelled it on the street or through the walls at the Serb upstairs, we were reminded that we were outnumbered, outweaponed, and we were winning. That first time we saw it, my mother and I together, she patted my shoulder, because these men were protecting Croatia, and the fighting didn't look too dangerous. She smiled, and the soup steamed, and even Rahela wasn't crying for once, and I allowed myself to slide into the fantasy I recognized as such, even while my mind was still spinning it. That there in the flat, with my family, I was safe. Chapter 3.
There is no way a doctor is going to see us on a Saturday,
my father said. My mother ignored him and continued filling her purse with bread and apples.
Dr. Kovic already called her. She knows we're coming.
Rahela had been vomiting for 2 weeks, the second of which my mother had spent taking unpaid sick days from school to navigate the complex web of communist healthcare, bouncing from doctor to doctor, receiving one referral, then the next, this doctor open only on Wednesdays, that one only Tuesdays and Thursdays, from 1 to 4. They had run blood tests, taken x-rays, one doctor to take the x-rays, another to read them, tried bottle feeding Rahela with a special formula that was expensive and nearly impossible to get. She'd only gotten skinnier, and my parents now stayed awake through the night, taking turns holding her upright so she wouldn't choke on her own vomit.
But Slovenia, Diana, how are we going to pay for it?
Our daughter is sick. I don't care how we are going to pay for it.
I carried Rahela out to her car seat. In Slovenia, there'd been a 10-day war. They didn't share a border with Serbia or have full access to the sea. They weren't the wrong ethnicity. Now Slovenia was a free country, a separate country. We passed through the desolate fields of northern Croatia, and my father slowed as a Slovenian police officer waved us toward a makeshift customs booth, hastily constructed to mark the new border. My father cranked down the window, and my mother dug through her purse for our passports. In winters past, we'd come to Slovenia to spend the day in Čatež, an indoor water park just over the border. Strange, I thought, to need a passport to go swimming. The policeman licked his thumb and flipped through our documents.
What's the purpose of your visit? We're visiting cousins,
my father said. I wondered why he didn't just tell the truth.
How long will you be staying?
Just for the day. A few hours.
Right,
said the officer, smirking. I remembered the inky square stamps we'd gotten when we'd driven to Austria once, but the man just scribbled something in pen in each of our passports and motioned us through. Unsure of what to expect from a whole new country, I was disappointed to see that Slovenia looked the same as I remembered it, looked the same as Croatia did in the rural parts outside of Zagreb, flat and blank and grassy against a backdrop of mountains that never seemed to get any closer.
You know I don't care about the money,
my father said, cracking the silence he'd been keeping since we'd left the house.
I know.
I'm just worried.
I know.
My father took my mother's hand and kissed the inside of her wrist.
I know,
she said. As we approached the capital, the population thickened, a dense buildup of houses clustered around the city. At its core, Ljubljana looked like a smaller, squatter version of Zagreb, except the river ran right through the town center rather than along the edge. The difference between Croatian and Slovenian was exasperatingly mild, the storefronts and street signs filled with words that looked familiar, but not quite right, rendering comprehension just out of reach.
This is not a doctor's office,
my father said when my mother instructed him to turn down an unmarked alley. He was over-articulating the way he did when he was frustrated.
That's it.
My mother pointed to a second-floor flat with a red cross taped to the front door. My father parked the car in front of a fire hydrant.
Good afternoon, a woman said in English, ushering us inside. I'm Dr. Carson.
I'd studied English since the first grade, but considered it a murky language, one whose grammar seemed to have been made up on the fly. Still, I resolved to concentrate and pick up as much as I could. Dr. Carson shook my parents' hands hard. The door of her flat opened directly into the living room, and she led us to her sofa, a fixture too big for the room and covered in pilling floral throw pillows. black and white photos of sickly children being hugged by toothy American doctors hung poster size on all walls. "Medi Mission," said the posters in block lettering beneath the photos, followed by an assortment of uplifting slogans about children and miracles and the future. Dr. Carson was thin and blonde and had the same teeth as the people in the posters, and I resolved to dislike her based on these things, the perkiness in her face that reminded me of the way teachers spoke to students who they thought were stupid. But I knew she was Rahela's best chance at getting better. Though Dr. Carson's uniform consisted of blue jeans, rubber gloves, and a stethoscope, she still had better equipment than all the real doctor's offices back home. She drew blood in her kitchen. "It's sterile," she said over and over, as if we had other options. I didn't like seeing Rahela's tiny arm pinned against the woman's countertop, though Rahela wasn't crying, hadn't cried since we arrived. She looked tired. I looked away, stared at an image of an Asian girl, half her face burned, contorted like gnarled tree bark. A doctor held her on his knee and applied a bandage. Dr. Carson ran more tests. She and my parents conversed in broken languages, my mother translating for my father in semi-coherent chunks. Rahela's kidneys weren't functioning properly, the ultrasound showed. It looked as if she might have only one, though the images were inconclusive even with the newer equipment. "There are better machines for these tests in other cities," Dr. Carson said. "But for now, we can try medication to stabilize." My mother barraged her with questions. The two switched completely to English, and my father and I stood back, fidgeting. Dr. Carson disappeared into her kitchen, then returned with a stack of papers and a small glass bottle of red and blue capsules. "Twice a day. We'll be in touch." At border control, my father cranked down the window and offered our passports to the approaching officer, whose eyes flitted between our faces and ID photos with increasing curiosity.
"Are you sure you want to go back over there?"
He gestured with his head toward the border and spoke with something between condescension and genuine concern. My father snatched at our papers and rolled the window up so fast I thought he might close the officer's hand inside. He opened his mouth to say something through the glass, but seemed to think better of it, and accelerated across the border into Croatia.
"What kind of question is that?"
he asked after a while, his voice raw.
"Of course we want to go back. Of course we're going home." "You awake?"
My father poked his head into the living room that night.
"I have a story for you."
I sat up on the couch with my back against the armrest. My father was holding my favorite book, Tales from Long Ago. The fairy tales inside were very old and very famous, and the copy we had was so worn we'd had to tape the middle pages back in. "Which one?"
"One day," he read, "a young man stumbled into Stribor's forest. He didn't know the forest was enchanted and that all kinds of magical creatures lived there. Some of the forest's magic was good, and some was evil, and the whole place would stay enchanted until the right person entered it to break the spell. Someone who preferred his own life, even with its sorrows, over all the ease and happiness in the world."
My father snapped the book shut, and I pretended to be patient, knowing he would continue, that he didn't need the words in front of him.
"The young man was headed home to his mother after chopping wood when—"
My father jumped up and feigned stumbling.
"He crossed the threshold into Stribor's kingdom. Inside, everything seemed to glow with little flecks of gold, as if it were coated in fireflies."
I tried to think of a place in Zagreb where everything was clean and twinkling, but the city did not feel very magical of late.
"And the woman who appeared before him in the clearing was no exception. She was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen."
"She wasn't," I said. "She was faking."
"You're right. The woman was really a snake in disguise. But the young man didn't know it. He was willfully blinded by her beauty.
His mother knew, though.
When the young man brought her home, his mother saw right away that the woman had the forked tongue of a serpent.
My father stuck out his tongue in a reptilian hiss.
The young man's mother tried to warn him, but he ignored her. He was happy, he insisted. Soon he and the serpent woman were married. The new daughter-in-law treated the young man's mother very badly. The mother was old, but the daughter-in-law made her work hard, cooking and cleaning and tending the garden. At night, the mother sat in her room and cried, wishing for a way out of her predicament.
And, I interrupted here, my favorite part, the fairies.
The fairies had heard the cry of one desperate for help. So, in the middle of the night, they flew up the mountainside to the village and into the house through the kitchen window.
What did they look like?
They were surrounded by a cloud of yellow light, and they each had two sets of paper-thin wings that fluttered so fast you could barely see them, like a hummingbird's.
I'd seen a hummingbird on TV once. He looked much too heavy to be hovering in midair like that.
The fairies picked the old woman up by the sleeves of her nightgown and carried her out of the village, down the mountain, and through the tall white oaks where Stribor, lord of the forest, was waiting for them. Now, Stribor lived in a golden castle inside the hollow of the biggest, strongest oak tree.
How did he fit the castle in a tree?
Magic, Anna. When the fairies had delivered the mother to his tree, he stepped outside. I am Stribor, lord of the forest. Who goes there?
My father bellowed in his best Stribor bass.
I am Brunhilda, and my son has married an evil serpent woman, he squeaked.
Brunhilda? I said. I laughed at the silly name, one my father changed in each retelling.
Ah, yes, Brunhilda. I know of your situation, and I can help you. As you know, I am very mighty and have many powers.
My father stuck out his chest and put his hands on his hips.
With my super magical powers, I can return you to your youth. I'll subtract 50 years from your age, so you'll be young and beautiful again. The woman was excited by the prospect of being young again, and out of the clutches of her evil daughter-in-law. She agreed. So Stribor stirred all the magic of the forest into motion.
My father paused for dramatic, stirring pantomime.
And a giant gate appeared before them. Stribor told the woman that when she passed through, she would go back in time. The woman had one foot over the threshold when she had a thought. Wait, what will happen to my son? Stribor scoffed at this question, which he thought was a stupid one. He won't be there, of course, in your new life, in your youth. The woman shied away. I'd rather know my son than live happily as a young woman without him, she said. And just like that,
my father snapped his fingers.
Stribor disappeared, and the magic of the forest was gone. The evil daughter-in-law became a snake again, the one who preferred her own sorrows to all the joys in the world, had entered the forest and broken the spell.
My father pulled the blanket up around my chin.
Do you understand, Anna? That sometimes hard things are worth the trouble.
I think so. Suddenly, I was very tired again.
Good.
My father kissed my forehead.
La Cunoche,
he said. He reshelved the fairy tales and turned out the lamp as I shrank down into the creases of the couch. Chapter 4. The presidential palace was rocketed 2 days later. In the shelter, my schoolmates and I waited for the all-clear to release us from the confines of mildew and shadows.
This shelter had bunk beds stacked 3 high, and while waiting for our turn on the generator bike, we'd made a game of clambering to the top level and jumping off, measuring our success by the volume of the smack our sneakers made against the cement floor. Our teacher, normally quick to snuff out such athletic outbursts, gave us a stern command not to break any bones, but let us continue. Something was taking longer than usual. I glanced sidelong at the butcher, self-nominated guardian of the door, his flabby form swaddled in a bloody apron. A handheld police scanner protruded from his front pocket, and he whispered with the cashier from the shop next to his. Then, almost frantically, he spun around and fumbled with the door latches, his thick hands moving faster than I'd ever seen them work behind his counter.
"Did you hear the signal?" Luca asked.
I hadn't, but the door was open, and the push of the crowd toward the stairs overpowered the spindly legs of children. Besides, we didn't want to miss out on the excitement. My classmates and I pressed against one another as we mounted the steps toward daylight. At first, the smell, the earthy scent of burning wood, the chemical stink of melted plastic, the stench of something sour and unfamiliar. Flesh, we'd learn. Then the smoke, 3 burgeoning columns above the upper town, broad and dense and dark red. It was not anxiety or excitement now, but real fear. I felt dizzy, as if someone had tied a rope around my middle and squeezed out all my air. Somewhere behind us, our teacher was shouting instructions for us to go home. Still, everyone who'd emerged from the shelter moved as one toward the explosion. I grabbed for Luca's hand. A girl beside me clutched a clump of my t-shirt, and the others joined until our whole class had formed a disorderly human chain. It was scarier now to separate than to walk into a city on fire. We reached the base of the stone steps that led to the upper town, toward Banski Dvori. The police had already blocked off the stairways, so we weaved through the adult crowd, pushing ourselves up onto a cement ledge to get a better view. My father worked in the transportation office in the upper town some days, though now I couldn't remember which. It wasn't close enough for him to have been hurt in this explosion, was it? In the haze, it was impossible to tell, and I scanned the faces of all the broad-shouldered men in sight, but did not find him. Fragments of conflicting reports churned around us.
"Have you heard? The president exploded right at his desk." "Come on, they've had him in a bunker since last week."
"Have you heard? His wife was inside, too."
A voice from behind.
"Are you kids up here alone?"
My classmates and I were startled to find someone talking to, rather than over us, the same shock of nerves firing as if we'd been caught sharing answers to a math test. I spun around to see a newsman wielding a large microphone and fiddling with a wire in his ear. He wore a gray vest with a sheen of nylon and metal.
"We're not alone," I said. "My dad just..."
"What's it to you?"
Luca cut in, puffing out his chest to mimic the man's bulky vest. The reporter, whose cameraman had come over to get a shot with the children, now stuttered.
"You should be at home," he said,
his apprehension exposing a French accent. His revealed foreignness dissolved any remaining authority.
"You should go home, Stranatz," I said, emboldened.
My classmates giggled, and I reveled in the girl's acceptance, if only momentary. I was brave, powerful even.
"Stranatz, Stranatz," my classmates chanted.
One of them threw an apple core, and it bounced off the newsman's padded shoulder.
"Oh, what do I care if you all blow up, you gypsy vermin," he said.
He motioned his cameraman to move a few feet over so we were out of the picture and began to refilm his report. Another explosion rumbled near the palace, then rippled down the hill through the concrete. A crack, thin as a strand of hair, bloomed across the ledge beneath our feet. Home suddenly didn't sound like such a bad idea. We took off, Luca and I sprinting down Ilitsa Street before our paths diverged.
"Good luck,"
I called as we split. It seemed afterward like a stupid thing to say, But another string of ambulances rounded the corner, sirens screaming as they passed, and if he replied, I didn't hear. I arrived home hyper and smelling of fire, swinging the door open with such force that I enlarged the dent, born of similar displays of overzealousness, in the opposite wall.
Where were you?
My mother yelled from her bed.